ASEA New Horizons, where law enforcement practitioners and academics get together to share knowledge and ideas to shape the future of crime analysis.
Hello, I'm joined by Dr. Derek Johnson today from Northumbria University in Newcastle, and I'm not going to introduce him because I am staring right at him now, and I think he has much more set to say than I do. So, Derek, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. Really pleased to do this, and great, yeah, thank you very much indeed. You need a bit of introduction because whatever's on the university website will be out of date, I'm sure. Well, yes, my name is Derek Johnson, and I was a serving police officer for 30 years, retired in 2008. While a lot of police officers retire and might go and play golf or something, I decided to be utterly daft and get another job and another career. So I moved from the South Coast right to the very far north of England and got this position as a lecturer at Northumbria University. At that time, I was delivering and leading an undergraduate program on crime science. Over the years, that came to an end, as many programs at universities do, sort of natural life. And I now lead a program, a master's program, the MSc in Disaster Management and Sustainable Development. In terms of what other work I've done at the university, what research work I've done, I've maintained my interest in crime and policing, done a number of projects, international projects, over the years. On sharing of fingerprint and DNA samples across international borders. That was a three-year project, very much in the all about the EU. And I'm now close to coming to the end in another international project, which we're doing with academics in the Netherlands and Sweden and Norway, which is all about policing TOR, being the onion router, more commonly known as the dark web. That's got about another 9 or 10 months to run. So I have certainly kept this policing stroke crime interest and many aspects of it. Yeah.
It's very interesting. Can I ask you about this dark web project? How's it going?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, it actually started as policing detectives on tour. It was about originally, but these things change. It was originally about the potential difficulties of policing the dark web, where in fact the dark web has a very good reason for existence, very legitimate reason for existence. But the bit that always gets reported is the criminal activity. So it's not as though it is just a criminal network, and so therefore you can just go and police it and investigate it and so on. There needs to be a balance reached. You really shouldn't be being too intrusive, because there are very legitimate needs for it. So it's a balance. It started out like that. In our perhaps naive belief that it could be digitally investigated. But that changed during the first 18 months of the project and the scoping exercise that we went through, where we established that you can't just go and digitally investigate it, because it really is anonymous. It's anonymous so long as the users follow guidelines which are published on there, and so don't give anything away. If they follow those guidelines, then they will remain anonymous. There is no way to get into it, to, hate to use the word, attack it as such. Our colleagues in Sweden are the computer scientists. My computer science knowledge amounts to knowing where the on-off button is on my laptop, and not really much further than that. But there is an arm of the project which is looking at the intricacies. And you can't just attack it and find out who a user is. It's far more involved than that. So our scoping exercise showed us that we needed to change. We really needed to understand the context of policing digital, let's call it digital crime, although there are many different names for it, cyber crime, cyber enabled crime, digital this, digital that. But if we just have this general name of digital crime, we'll use that for this conversation. And we really did need to understand the policing context. And really that's where I came in as a geographer, because I'm doing this with colleagues from our law school who are, for fairly obvious reasons, more interested and more focused on legal aspects, whether that actually be law or whether it's guidelines or whether it's how prosecutors follow and so on and so forth, or routes they follow. But context is, that's geography. Mm-hmm. Geographer, I want to know context. Context, context, context. If you don't understand context, you'll never understand the issue. So we had to have a bit of a rethink, really. Of course, we were totally concentrated on the English police forces, England and Wales. And we found that there are significant issues with digital policing in English police forces. That's not to say they don't do some great things. They do. They really do some great work. And they are continuing to do so. They are, together with the National Crime Agency and the College of Policing and so on and so forth and other agencies, there is some really good stuff going on. And they are looking to future things as well. 5G. Mm-hmm. 5G will come on board and all of a sudden your mobile phone, instead of being a briefcase, will become a suitcase in terms of the amount that it can hold, and the amount that it can collect, the amount that is available. So that poses a risk, but they are working on that. So there are some great steps forward. But what we found was there are integration problems. And again, as a geographer, I think of place and space. And so imagine your home. So you go home and there's your house. It's a little detached house with a garden, and your partner lives there, and you have a child there, and there's fencing all the way around it. When you get there, then you know that is your place. And that's relatively easy for us all to capture in our minds, capture on a map. It's got a coordinate, you know where it is. You can count it. So you can count it in as much as you could put it on a map, and you could put your friend's place on a map, and another one, and another one, and you can count them. They're real, kind of real, aren't they? That's your place. But it's also your space. But it's not your space until you walk through the garden gate. Whilst you're on the pavement outside, that's not your space. Your space is very limited. Your space is probably the area around you, within arm's reach, perhaps. Don't know, it might be a bit further, but you know, it's limited. You don't own it. It's not your place. You're there quite legitimately. You're using that place. But your space is limited. The moment you walk through that garden gate, you are in your space. Let's imagine you bought that house a year ago. And when you bought it 1 year ago, your space was really quite different, quite restrictive, because it was brand new to you. You hadn't created that space. But a year on, you created that space. It's yours. You've done some work in the garden. You've decorated. You've put furniture there. You have a child there, and the child's happy in that space. It's their space as well, and their space is different to your space. Your partner has a different space. You share the space, but it's personal. So your space is very personal, but no, it's shared. And there is certainly, as you can imagine, a great deal of commonality between your space and your partner's space. I said that space is the whole, is everything, isn't it? It's the whole building, it's the garden, it's maybe the garage, it's wherever you are there, you have your own space in the place that you're in. But it's created through your own feelings, your emotions, your opinions, your thoughts, your actions, and so on. If we now conceptually take that up a scale and think of the police force. Say you work for a police force. So in England, that's likely to be a county. So we say, right, you work in this police force, you know its place, because you can see its place on a map. It's got a boundary. Okay, if you go into the next county, you're still a police officer, but you're actually in, you know, you're the policing place of the force you work in is within its boundaries. That's its place. So how can we think about the space of that police force? Well, we should be able to, because the common thing about the space of that police force is policing in whatever form that takes, whether that's uniform officer on patrol, whether it's a member of administrative staff dealing with, I don't know, court documents or whatever, or administrative capacity, they are still functioning for the purpose of policing that place. So there is a space, isn't there? There's a policing space within that police place. And when we thought about this, we thought, well, how does digital play into this? And that is a problem. And it's a problem because we have a very digital society, even more so now as a result of the pandemic, where there has been more and more reliance on data, communicating digitally, as we are doing today. Would we be doing this in the way we're doing it if there wasn't this ease of digital access? Probably not. So it has really come to the fore in the pandemic. And we have a very digital society. Not entirely. There are people who aren't, for whatever reason, and we won't go along that route because that'll be another 20-minute conversation. But there are those who aren't. But generally speaking, we're in a digital society. and policing should reflect that. But when we started looking into it, we ran some workshops with some very diverse set of professionals, ran a few workshops, and the scoping exercise we did, we find that digital really hasn't integrated across the space of policing. And there are some serious issues with it. So one example is that there are many investigators who would take the stance, oh, it's digital, I don't do digital. Well, I'm sorry, but if a young man or woman burgles a house, are you telling me they haven't got a smartphone, that they're not probably leaving that house, or maybe while they're in that house, texting somebody to see if they'll buy this piece of jewellery that you happen to be staring at before you steal it? That's digital. So, the digital aspect really is in every aspect of policing, but it hasn't got there. It hasn't integrated across that space. You still have, especially on the, let's call it the front line or the lower level crimes, you've still got a virtually non-digital policing space. Not entirely, but virtually non-digital. Instead, the digital is in the cyber units, with the cyber investigators, with the specialists. So you have a lot of siloing going on. Oh, it's digital, I don't do that. I've got to give that to the cyber unit. Well, okay, maybe the cyber unit does have the skills, knows the right keys to press, and can do what is needed or could be done. But because the whole thing hasn't integrated effectively across all the spaces, you don't have one big, inclusive, digitally integrated policing space. Does that make sense? I'm not sure.
That does make sense. And you can see I'm confused because we use geography. I was going to ask you how geography fits in crime. However, I can see and I can understand how it does. What confuses me is that we use geographical intelligence, open source intelligence, which is, am I right in saying that's part of that digital sort of space? So how is this not being integrated effectively?
Okay. Well yes, but you have, there's been a couple of pieces of work. I know of two, I understand there have been more, where people have looked at whether, kind of asked the question of X number of police officers from diverse ranges, do you do any digital, open source type digital stuff? And the majority do. In the Met Police in London, they found, I don't quote me on the percentages because I don't know them off the top of my head, but a high volume of patrol officers, uniform patrol officers, said, quite a lot for people who ask me directions. I get my phone out and I look it up on Google Maps, or I look it up on the web. Well, is that your phone? Yeah, well, I don't get supplied with one. It has to be on my phone and I just do it. Or I might be looking at a missing person inquiry and I'll see whether they've been on, they've got a Facebook page or something like this. So they are doing open source intelligence gathering, but there would be an argument, well, they're not doing it properly. They're not doing it with the right authorities, the right guidelines, and so on and so forth. But then they don't have the equipment or resources to be able to do it quite properly. There's no suggestion that really is unlawful, that it's for bad purposes or whatever. So I don't want to come across in that way. I don't want people thinking I'm moaning and complaining and saying it shouldn't happen, but that's just the fact of it. So it kind of has integrated, but then it hasn't integrated. Yeah, so the a supervisor says to the officer, oh, can you go and do some inquiries about this missing person? Why hasn't it had some sort of digital input right at the very beginning?
Because there's no space within these places for that.
It's not in the space of the supervisor. That's not to say that it's personal about the supervisor.
Yeah.
It's not in the supervisor's space because no one's ever actually put it in that space.
Exactly.
Or said that it should be part of your space. Mm-hmm. And that is a very well recognised problem that we came across, that we were told about. It's common not just in England. It was common in the other countries involved in our project. Can't say that about Sweden because their aspect has been the technical. Mm-hmm. Certainly in Netherlands, yeah. Significant problem that's identified there by the police, and this is also identified by the police over here, is the digital is not fed through to the frontline workers. The training isn't there.
Yeah.
And that leads you to intelligence. If say you're a PCSO or just any officer who is sat in Granny Smith's house having a cup of tea with her, and she says, oh, I'm getting really annoyed with my grandson, granddaughter. They just spend all their time in their bedroom, and it's always such a mess. And you think, oh, yeah, okay, so it's a teenager. We've all been there. But then she produces a scrap of paper. And she says, I keep finding notes like this. Throws it at you. And you look at it, oh, well, I don't know what it is, I'll throw it away. And then the next day, another officer with digital knowledge, having just done some training, if only, comes in, cup of tea with Granny Smith, and she says, oh, no, there's another scrap of paper. He looks at it and says, that's a Bitcoin key. That's a good piece of intelligence. What are the chances of that being picked up? At the moment, very, very low. So there is a lot, potentially, there is actually a lot of intelligence that is not being picked up and not being used, which actually is, that takes me back to the 1960s and 70s, where your intelligence was coming from your patrol officers, your beat officers, being fed into a system which didn't work particularly well. It wasn't particularly understood, or et cetera, et cetera. But it was there. There was a reliance and an understanding that your frontline officers knew a lot, collected a lot, and could pass a lot on. Changes happened in structures and policing philosophies, and a lot of that was lost because your community beat officers were swallowed up into other things. But then it's resurrected about 20 years later in the 1990s. Again, oh gosh, we're losing contact with the community. Let's resurrect it. So it was resurrected. Then it died off again. In about 2010, the security services, and this is nothing secret about this, it was the head of MI5 who did some public appeals and appeared on news programs and so on and so forth. In fact, there was a kind of like an advert, it was really was a public appeal, where I can't remember whether it was a he or she at the time, but I think it was a he, actually said, you, the people, you possess the information, please pass it to us. And he was regenerating this local community knowledge base and contact with the local community knowledge base because it had been lost. And it's as though, well, we're back there again in terms of digital. It's not fully integrated across the policing space. Mm-hmm. So therefore, there is a lot of intelligence lost, potentially.
And it's a shame, because that could save lives and also prevent crime, which is why we have ILP, to prevent crime, being proactive rather than reactive.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yes. But there's a great deal of reactive going on still. You still got a reactive philosophy.
But my question to you, I'm so interested in this. And geography plays a massive part in crime. It really, really does. What would you like to see happen?
I think there needs to be, some might call it a culture change, but there needs to be culture changes as well. There needs to be a philosophical change. That we are in this digital age, and therefore that has to get in that space and be pushed through that space. Of course, there is an argument that we're not in a digital age. If we look at ages, we have a Victorian age, we have an industrial age. We're really good at putting labels on things, aren't we? We're fantastic at that. We should all have PhDs for labelling. So there are these ages. And many would say, we're in the digital age. Yeah. Started around about the 1970s, believe it or not. It's just that if you wanted to carry a computer around in 1970, you had to somehow be able to tow a warehouse. But it did start then, and it's developed, and now it's sort of, yeah, we all know it's moved on very, very rapidly. We're in this digital age. Are we? No, we're not really, are we? There is a strong philosophical argument put forward by a chap called Berry, which has been picked up by many, that no, we're not in a digital age. If we look back 10 years ago, then doing what you and I are doing now would be fine. It would be very restricted to a place. I couldn't lift the laptop. Well, I could, but not particularly easy, not so easily could I lift my laptop up and move to a different room and continue all the conversation and so on and so forth. It was about where. It was about hardware. Yeah. And it was about place. It's not anymore, is it? I could be doing this on my mobile phone.
Anywhere as well. You could do it on the train. You could do it waiting for a train. You could do it anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not so tied to hardware anymore. Instead, Berry will say, we're in a post-digital age now. And really, we have been for about the last 10 years, where the technology isn't constantly creating a new piece of hardware. Instead, it's constantly creating very, very quickly software. And that is all about coding. Mm-hmm. You don't buy a physical thing as a piece of software, do you? It's coding. Yeah. And we're in a post-digital age. The knowledge needs to be around coding. The police service is in the digital age, but it's quite early on in the digital age. Certainly not in the post-digital age, because I don't think you've got any analysts, any senior investigators who could explain to a judge the coding of the software they used to analyse X, Y, and Z.
I agree with that, and what a way to finish. Are you sure there's nothing else you want to say? Because I am very engaged with this conversation, because it's so, again, it's not something, I'm speaking to someone else on one of the podcasts. This is not a topic that I think about or I read about. Of course, I said to you, I study crime science, but that was very much forensics. There was not much emphasis on geography and all the other sources that can come into those decisions when studying for those areas. But this is really, really interesting. And I agree with you that maybe the police force has a lot of work to do And like you say, some people argue it's a culture change, but I agree with you, it's more than that. More needs to be done to keep up to date, because ultimately criminals are always one step ahead of us. That's what I believe.
Well, they're not one step ahead really. They are one aisle further on in the shop.
I like
than
that.
The police service.
Yes, I like
police
that.
Services walk through the door and is looking at the stuff that's on the bargain shelf because it's reaching close to best before date. The criminal is 2 hours further along. They're buying the stuff that only came in the store yesterday. Think of it like that.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. I mean, from a totally personally biased point of view, I would also say that geography needs to get into policing more. Geography of crime tends to be thought of as, oh yeah, well that's putting things on a map, pins in a map on the wall. That's geography of crime. Mm-hmm. Look at the patterns. And my argument would be, well, actually, no, it is far greater than that. I do GIS. I've done and published quantitative analytical work about the behavior of criminals and how you can understand it and plot it, and you can predict it through spatial analysis. And I've generated a predictive ability. So yeah, that was all quantitative. That was about maps. So yes, that is a very positive side of the geographies of crime. But people just think that's all it is. But it's not. It's far more than that. We've been talking actually about the geography of crime. It does fit in there.
Yeah.
Crime pattern through environmental design. Sorry, crime pattern. Crime prevention through the environmental design. That's, yeah, there are distinct geographies in that. That's an aspect of the geography of crime. So it does that, yeah, but that's not purely quantitative spatial analysis at all. But it is about human behavior in places and spaces. It's geography then, isn't it?
Yeah. It fits with crime. It does. It fits in with everything.
It does, yes.
We will have Place and Spaces part two coming up. No, Derek, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to do. Yeah.
Thank you.
And now let's get to this episode's science snippets for analysis with me, Suzanne Knaber-Nicole from Police Science Doctor. Geographic profiling. Research has consistently revealed that offenders generally victimize areas they are familiar with, thereby concentrating on targets within their immediate environment. You'll find the link to the original article in this episode's show notes.